Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on a really cold, overcast, dark day in Concord, New Hampshire. We begin our show virtually almost every day between now and the election with the poem America's a Gun by Brian Bilstone. Of course, it's because of things like Uvalde and Parkland and Buffalo and all the mass shootings that have occurred in America. Here we go. England is a cup of tea, France a wheel of ripened brie, Greece a short, squat olive tree. America's a gun. Brazil is football on the sand. Argentina, Maradona's hand. Germany, an umpa band. America's a gun. Holland is a wooden shoe. Hungary, a goulash stew. Australia, a kangaroo. America's a gun. Japan is a thermal spring. Scotland is a highland fling. Oh, better to be anything than America as a gun. And we also link at my Facebook page to everytownresearch.org, which lists the numbers of mass shootings in America in 2022. That list is updated daily. How sad is that? If it's Friday, it is our regular check-in with Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the editor of the Quorum Report. And you did not know this because you were not with us last week, Mr. Braddock. But what you need to know is I've been telling everyone I'm finally taking my mask off. And I go to places when I know there aren't a lot of people in the grocery store or in public space. So
you weren't doing that before last week?
Yeah, this is just 1 week. It's my first week to do this. So,
how does it make you feel?
Well, this is how it should make you feel. So I told my audience last week that I'm walking down the aisle and all of a sudden I hear this woman scream out, "I love Scott Braddock. I love Scott Braddock." I went, "Excuse me?" And then she goes, "Oh yeah, and I like Lincoln Mitchell too." It was hilarious. So, but that's what happened just last week, and you weren't here. But let me tell you what happened Sunday.
Arnie, is part of it because you don't have the mask on, they can see who you are. And so now, you know, they're associating you with all these people.
Yeah, no, no.
Would people recognize you when you were walking with the mask on?
No, they never were. And so the mask is, now that the mask is off, the first time in 2.5 years, suddenly people are like connecting.
Adulation, connection.
My God. And, but here's the other thing. So I'm at the international festival. We had a multicultural festival on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And I could not believe how many people came up to me to tell me how much they loved the show. But guess what? Your name came up 4 times.
Wow, these people they're twisted. I think maybe there's something wrong. We're all broken, Arnie.
No,
we are all actually broken.
Well, no. Texas is so important.
I'm being self-deprecating, of course. But you know what Hemingway said was that, the world breaks everyone, but just some people get stronger at the broken places. So
thank you. I just want to let you know that you have really brought Texas into their lives in a really important way. That's a good thing for the country. And
They get it. Here's the thing. Because you have listeners who get it. They listen and they understand why we're doing this, because in so many ways we lead the country in, you know, some of the worst ideas. And we've certainly cemented that in the last 24 months.
Well, so let's start with some of the topics today. And in some ways, these two are almost connected. A Texas sheriff is investigating Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for potentially deferring immigrants to get them on flights to the East Coast. Of course, where did he get those immigrants? But he got them from Texas. And then you also have a sort of a denouement, a second point to that. Governor Greg Abbott doubles down on immigration politics as he fends off the challenge from Beto O'Rourke. So let's talk about the DeSantis-Abbott connection when it comes to what happened at Martha's Vineyard.
Interesting. I had a lot of people in the last couple of weeks asking me whether Governor DeSantis and Governor Abbott were working together on this. And everything that I see indicates the exact opposite, that they're sort of competing on this, trying to look like they're the toughest governor when it comes to illegal immigrants in Texas, even though one of them isn't the governor of Texas. And so you had Abbott, who for months, remember, Arnie, this is only really catching on now. It's sort of getting traction now. Abbott announced it back in April. It was a while back that he was going to start busing migrants to the quote blue cities. He was going to send undocumented folks from Texas to places like New York City, D.C. He didn't mention Martha's Vineyard, but of course, Governor DeSantis had to show him up and basically try to steal the spotlight on the steal. Everything that Abbott has been, and here's, you know, here was the sort of the joke on our podcast here in Texas last week, the Texas Take, was only Governor DeSantis could make Abbott look like a humanitarian or something with the way that he's doing this, because Abbott I mean, look, the way that Abbott has been doing it, and there have been some questions about whether the migrants who got on buses that have been paid for by the state of Texas, some questions about whether they were defrauded and lied to about what was going to happen, where they were going to be taken. Although, if you look at it, Arnie, and I was talking about this with my co-host, Jeremy Wallace, who works at the Houston Chronicle. And I said, look, so much of this is all about the way you talk about it, right? So if you had a program where you were going to use government funds to give migrants free rides to places where there would be job opportunities and services for them, you could mistake that for a Democratic program or a liberal program, right? But the way Abbott's talking about it is not to say I'm helping the migrants, right? What he's saying is, I'm teaching those liberals in these other places a lesson by sending our, quote, problem from the Texas border up to their cities, right? So that plays well with the Republican base. But if you talked about it the way I talked about it at first, they would say, whoa, what is this? And in fact, some conservatives have criticized it that way. Marsha Blackburn, who's no liberal, a U.S. senator from Tennessee, had said that she thought that it was wrong to be giving these people free rides across the country because it is some sort of a welfare program, almost, is the way that she put it. But what did Ron DeSantis do? And why is the Bexar County Sheriff in San Antonio, Texas, looking into him? Well, what happened, this is the allegation, is that DeSantis, somebody with the state of Florida, that they hired someone to basically lure migrants to go on a plane ride. And this happened in San Antonio, where I was just a couple of days ago. And actually, I was in San Antonio when the Bexar County Sheriff announced he was going to start a criminal investigation of this, that these migrants were lured by somebody who was promising them all sorts of things. And they got 50 people, rounded them up and put them on a plane to Martha's Vineyard. And of course, there was also this talk that and some chatter that there was going to be a plane ride again from Texas to Joe Biden's house, President Biden's house in Delaware, to teach him a lesson. So what happens when these migrants get to and we'll see what happens with the, you know, the criminal investigation. Who knows, you know, exactly what might have transpired there. Although, Arnie, as far as I can tell, it may well fall under kidnapping statutes. And I was reminding people online earlier this week. I just asked this question. Does Governor Santis know, has anyone told him that most prisons in Texas don't have air conditioning? He would probably be better off to have that information. Yeah, exactly. So we'll see what happens with Governor DeSantis. And he's sort of being a wise guy about all this. And he's trying to amp things up and overshadow Abbott in a lot of ways. Abbott, who has been, you know, getting some traction with this stunt. And it is a stunt. It's having effects that maybe I didn't expect back in April when it was first announced, but it is a stunt, right? And the White House has criticized it that way. And some Democrats have said that this is potentially kidnapping. And now you have the sheriff saying, hey, that, you know, we at least need to look into that, right, and figure out whether any laws were broken here. Again, this is the rule of law folks who are all telling us that we need to understand what the law is when it comes to immigration, but they may not care that they're actually breaking kidnapping laws in the United States to try to make their point. So look, when it comes to the couple of things about this politically, Arnie, I do think that this is mostly being done. And when you think of hardcore immigration politics, which is what this is really, it's at its core, this is anti-immigrant. It's, anti-migrant, it's anti-brown people. You know, the way that these politicians are talking about it. And to me, that usually signals that we're in a primary election, that if this is your main message, you're talking about immigration, that this is how you win a Republican primary, particularly in Texas, but also around the country in a presidential primary in 2024. So if Abbott and DeSantis aren't working together on this, because there's no indication that DeSantis told Abbott that he had, you know, sent people into Texas to try to round up migrants here and take them to the East Coast. If they're competing over this to look the toughest on immigration in this way, then that would indicate to me that maybe both of these guys think that their re-elections this year are locked up, you know, that they're going to win. Abbott and DeSantis are going to win, and they're looking ahead to 2024, and they're trying to woo the Republican base that way. Now, that can be part of it. I don't know that that's the whole thing. So if you think about the base of the GOP right now and how in a lot of ways they are demoralized because of, you know, the ongoing questions about the bogus questions about the 2020 election. Mm-hmm. President Trump just won't go away, right? He's the former president. And I've started to say that, you know, this is maybe just as much Trump's second midterm as it is Biden's first midterm, because Trump is just still there. He's just part of American life in a way that other presidents in the past haven't been when after they retired or got beat. So if it's Trump's midterm, what does that mean? Republicans don't do as well. If it's Biden's midterm, Democrats could just be, you know, destroyed politically all over the place. But if it's both their midterm, that kind of evens the playing field. So then what happens? So then you have to look at other issues other than just the president's approval ratings, right? So what has the base of the Democratic Party fired up, and what issues fire them up and extend beyond the base of the Democratic Party? Number one, gun violence. You mentioned Uvalde at the beginning and the America is a Gun poem. You have so many people who are not just Democrats who are upset about that, right? A lot of soccer moms, a lot of people who are in the suburbs who are open to voting for Republicans. I was talking to a Republican operative yesterday that said for the last 6 months worth of internal polling they've done for various campaigns, women under 45 are saying no to Republicans. They can't even get them. And it doesn't matter if they voted for Republicans in the past. And guns is a big issue that's driving that. The other big issue driving that same thing, of course, is abortion rights after the Dobbs decision. And I asked this guy, this Republican, I said, how much does it have to do with the abortion ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court? And he said, it is just destroying Republicans all over the place, particularly in suburban counties here in Texas and in other places around the country. So if Democrats and some other people are fired up about those issues, Republicans need to fire up their issue, their base, about something else, right? And so what are they focused on? They're focused on illegal immigration. They have a case to make. Look, you've got a record number of migrants coming from Venezuela into Texas right now. Of course, think about what they're fleeing in Venezuela to come here, to come to Texas. You would think old school Republicans would say, hey, if you're fleeing socialism, come into the United States, we'll all welcome you with open arms. But instead, of course, they're playing what I would simply call anti-brown people politics. And you have them firing up their base in a way that is, and this has always been the way it's been with immigration for the last 15, 20 years, the base of the Republican Party, when they hear illegal immigrant, they hear something that triggers the thing in their brain that is like what would fire up voters in the South when George Wallace would use the N-word. And remember, he had said that he, after he got beat by another politician who was, you know, stoking fears of race, you know, fears of black people, Wallace had said he would never be out N-worded again. Remember that quote? And so from that day forward, it was all about that. And so I do think that this is really something where Republicans are trying to level the playing field, make it a little easier. And look, other issues kind of seem to be slipping away from them. The economy, those attacks on the president don't seem to be landing in quite the same way, although we do have interest rates going up. And that's, I think, moving forward toward the election, that's something to watch.
There was no housing to buy anyway. I mean, let's be honest here. Right. I mean, I hate to say this, we have such a problem with housing anyway, that interest rates would be an issue if you could buy a house like 5 years ago, but you can't buy a house because they don't exist.
Well, that's fair. But I guess my point is that don't look for like great economic news for the president for the next 6 weeks. Right. However, I do think that when it comes to the attacks on inflation, when people have talked about inflation, what they mostly mean is the price of gas. And you and I both know that, number one, the price of gas is coming down, which doesn't make people happy about it, but it makes them less angry. The attack doesn't have the same power that it had before. And the price of gas isn't really an inflation issue, right? The other things, like going to the grocery store being more expensive, and those worldwide other things being commodity. More expensive. Yeah. It's a worldwide commodity. It's traded on the world stage. And there's so many other things that impact the price of gasoline. In fact, you may know that it's so complicated that the price of a barrel of oil can be going down when the price of gasoline is going up, and vice versa. They're almost delinked because of various market factors. And so we'll start to see some of that improve. It seems the economic messages that are being used against Democrats don't have quite the same stoutness, the same power they had before. And so Republicans need other things to talk about. And guess what? They're talking about immigration. And one other thing about the flights and the busing of the migrants, it's also Republicans learning a little lesson, I think, maybe, and this is me being sort of putting a silver lining on it, some sort of hopefulness, maybe, that Republicans have learned they can't just copy Donald Trump about all these issues. They have to come up with their own thing. Remember earlier in the year when Governor Abbott was building the Texas border wall, and that was his big thing, and he didn't really get that much attention for it outside of Texas, where he was running in a primary. To get all this national attention, he had to do something that was a little more unique, something that he came up with instead, which was this busing of the migrants to the north, which harkens back to a terrible time in the South when racists would put black people on buses back to the north as well. That there's nothing new under the racist sun. This is just sort of repackaged.
All right, let me just go back to almost the very beginning where we talked about women under the age of 45 and what is resonating with them are the issues of guns and the issue of abortion. Can I just tell you something? That's life and death. Yeah. That is life and death. The immigration issue is not life and death. But what you are talking about, what women are so concerned about,
is protecting
their children.
You know why it's such a good point, Arnie, but continue with that, because it is life and death for people here.
Yes.
Right. Well, you know, the thing about, you know why immigration is one of those issues that's very hard for Democrats to come up with any sort of a counterpunch on it, that it's hard for Democrats to have a counter argument on it that is potent in an election, because, and this is just one of the dirty secrets about the issue, and Republicans know this, when they're attacking anyone who is, you know, pro-immigration, pro-immigrant, right, the person who's pro-immigrant is advocating on behalf of someone who can't vote for them. Right. They're not citizens, so they can't vote. There's not a big net positive. Republicans are always running around saying, oh, wow, they want all these undocumented people here so that they can vote for Democrats. But the reality is they can't and they don't. Right. In fact, in South Texas, a lot of Democratic consultants would tell you that it's hard enough to get legal Latinos to go vote in November. This whole idea that undocumented people are doing it is ridiculous and stupid. But it is a humanitarian issue. And so to your point, all of these, I mean, to bolster your point, all of these are life and death issues. The issues of abortion, the issue of whether you can drop your kid off at school and not fear that they're going to be gunned down with an AR-15. This is the kind of thing that keeps parents up at night, and it should. And if you look at what happened in Uvalde, you think about the fact that it's over 3 months now, more than 3 months since that happened. One of the mothers who I follow on Twitter, and her Twitter feed is just heartbreaking. Every day she tweets out things like, I wish it was me and not you. Every day about her daughter. Every day she tweets out, I can't forgive myself for leaving her at that school that day. As if it was some big decision to make in the morning, right? That she was going to maybe not drop her off at school. But after something like that happens, you question everything.
I know.
And for those people, even though it's, you know, 3 months ago or more for us, it's every day for them. So, and guess what? For mothers all over the place, I hear this from women all over Texas, it doesn't matter what part of the state I go to, they feel it's every day for them too, because they know it could happen anywhere at any time.
So there's a really interesting comment that you put on as a possible talking point. I am almost shocked by it. You write, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick pushes back on rumors that he's told GOP state senators they need to prepare for the possibility he may lose his race to his Democratic challenger, Mike Collier. Mm-hmm. And my understanding, I mean, I've interviewed Mike on this radio show. Mm-hmm. Wasn't Mike a former Republican?
He was.
Okay. So let's explain to everyone, how is it possible that the most powerful man in Texas politics, which really is the little governor, the lieutenant governor, how is it possible that he is actually concerned about Mike Collier? Because it sounds like something that would be remarkable. And if he's concerned about Mike Collier, then how can Abbott not be concerned about Beto? Because I can't imagine voting for Collier and not voting for Beto.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, this is the first midterm in Texas since the law was changed such that we don't have one punch straight ticket voting anymore. You can't go into the ballot box. You can't go to the voting booth and push the one button for all Republicans or all Democrats. It's over with. So it's every man for himself in a lot of ways. And I think the campaigns are thinking of it that way now. Some of the internal polling that I've seen, Arnie, and the public polling in Texas, without being too critical of any specific university or polling outlet, it's been pretty bad. I mean, we're in September, and you would expect that public polling would be of likely voters, right? In September. If you're talking about polling for a general election in January, February, there's no way to know what a likely voter looks like. But by September and October, you should have some idea by this time of the year. But one of the polls that showed Abbott, I think, with a 7-point advantage over Beto, one of those polls just came out in the last couple of weeks. It was surveying, quote, self-declared registered voters. What does that mean? That means people who went online and said that they're registered voters without checking to see if they actually are. So that's how great the polling is right now. Some of the internal polling I've heard about on the Republican side shows it to be more like a 3 or 4 point race between Abbott and Beto. So watch that space. Now, if Abbott is only leading Beto by 3 or 4, and you are Dan Patrick or you are the ag commissioner, Sid Miller, the comptroller, Glenn Hager, you got to worry about that in an environment where Abbott has all the money in the world to get himself over the finish line. And he's going to be focused like a laser on that and not necessarily on helping you. Now, Patrick has something like $24 or $27 million in the bank. He's going to be spending, you know, a ton of that to try to get himself reelected. But if you go back to 2018, think of this, Arnie. There was a big separation between Abbott and other Republicans on the ballot. This is when Beto almost beat Ted Cruz.
Right.
And you had Republicans, including Dan Patrick, who barely won their races by 2 or 3 points. And it was a real wake-up call for them. But at that same time, on the same ballot, Abbott beat his Democratic challenger, Lupe Valdez, by 13 points. So wow. Abbott has a lot more room to maneuver. And we have, you know, sort of these Republicans who are thought of as sort of the old school Republicans, even though they haven't been acting that way lately. But in a lot of ways, they do campaign this way. John Cornyn beat his Democratic opponent by 10 points when President Trump at the same time was only carrying Texas by 6. Mm-hmm. Abbott beat his opponent by 13 points when Beto almost beat Cruz, and that was a 3-point race. So this year, if Abbott's really struggling, and he's only 3 points ahead of Beto, which I could believe 3 points, I could believe 7 points. Like I said, these polls are all over the map. But if there is that real concern and there is no one punch straight ticket voting like there was in 2018,
yeah.
Right? Those results happened with straight ticket voting in 18. Then if I'm Dan Patrick, I might be freaked out. Now, I'll tell you this real quick. My reporting was, and I had some sources on this. We reported it out at quorumreport.com. Some top Republican state senators have apparently had one-on-one conversations with Patrick that were very blunt, very candid about all this. And what Patrick apparently told them is that if we want to keep a conservative agenda alive and going in Texas, if I, Dan Patrick, lose my race, you state senators are going to have to reorganize the Senate. And what you're going to have to do is strip the lieutenant governor's office of its power, which they can do.
I know.
They can do through their rules, and instead have the Republican senators run the Senate. Now, that's a very serious comment for him to have been made. His campaign says that that's not true, although I'll stick by my reporting.
Sense.
I mean, that's
just
this didn't something. Just get made up. And the other thing that was very interesting was a few things. One, Patrick instructed apparently his chairman in the Senate to not have he doesn't want them to have any more hearings of any kind in the Senate until the election is over with. He doesn't want them out there spewing right wing things during the election, because look, the state senators and the representatives, they're all pretty much safe in their districts. Yeah. Now, we just did redistricting, so they can kind of say whatever they want. I was also told that Patrick told his Republican senators, and this is the key. This is what really makes me think that he thinks he's in some danger, that he told these Republican senators to tamp down any talk of school choice and school vouchers until the election is over, because that's the kind of thing that costs Republicans votes in rural areas. And they have got to pump up the Republican vote in rural areas to offset the surging of the Democrats in the major urban areas.
And I just want to remind everyone that you can gerrymander senators and state reps. You can't gerrymander a state. So therefore, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has to run statewide, just the way Governor Abbott has to run statewide. Any statewide official has to be more nervous, especially if we're seeing kind of an interesting surge going on the Democrats. And as you mentioned, every woman under the age of 45 is totally apoplectic about what the agenda is of the GOP. And while they may not be able to have a real choice in their district for state Senate, they do have a choice at the top of the ticket. Just real quickly, though, if Mike Collier does have the potential to win, what's he running on against Dan Patrick? What is he using as his axe to grind to really sort of focus on Patrick and say, this man is a problem for you?
Three main things. Number one, in his television advertising and on the campaign trail, Collier says Patrick did not, quote, fix the damn grid, close quote.
Okay.
The electricity grid has been top of mind in his campaign. The other thing is property taxes in the state are very high. And Patrick, for 15 or 20 years, has railed about property taxes and said he would do something to fix it. Collier says he hasn't. And I think a lot of homeowners all across the state would agree with that. And one thing about property taxes in Texas, Arnie, because of the influx of so many people in suburban Texas, so many people who are coming from other places who land in suburban Dallas-Fort Worth, suburban Houston, suburban Austin, San Antonio, you have so many. I think this is one of the most important demographic shifts in Texas that nobody talks about. There are so many more people who are homeowners who are open to voting for Democrats, which was not the case a decade ago. The vast majority of homeowners would have been Republicans probably, you know, almost all of them. So here, and certainly in those places. And then the third thing that that Collier is really beaten up on Patrick about is his support, is Patrick's support for school vouchers, which is deeply unpopular in rural Texas, where, of course, you have Republicans in desperate need of turning out the rural vote to offset those votes in places like Houston and Dallas.
And I want to remind everyone, you've taught us this so much, that what is the most important thing that goes on, especially in rural Texas, it's the football team at the high school. And the idea that you would somehow pull kids out of public school, it is the heart and soul of those rural communities. And
defunding, I think that, defunding high school football in Texas for a voucher program?
Thank you very much.
Didn't go over well.
I know. That's what you've taught me, Scott. Scott Braddock is the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the editor of the Quorum Report. If it's Friday, it must be Mr. Braddock. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
All right. Ciao, everyone. Stick around. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 19.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 19.
Welcome back to the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill, we're recording on Thursday morning. If it is Friday, it must be Bill Curry. Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician who's been a two-time Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut and a White House advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton. He was the head of the Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Curry.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And a regular with Bill is Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson has been an editor at the American Prospect. He's written about virtually everything when it comes to issues, especially of labor. You can read his articles in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Nation, The New Statesman. He's just he's won numerous awards, and he was a senior fellow. I don't think you're still a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. You may be. But more importantly, every time I go to the American Prospect, I keep going, okay, if I have a question about labor, what's Harold writing about? And sure enough, there you are, Harold. So thank you so much for joining us.
Always good to be here, Arnie.
All right, so Bill and Harold, I tweeted something out as I was watching Letitia James, and it was an amazing moment to hear her sort of talk in such a forceful way with 280 pages of documentation to support really the facts. I mean, you know, he can be accused of fraud, but when you look at all the numbers, I don't know what else you would call it. I tweeted this out, and I really do need to talk about it. I wrote, do you think Trump and family are the only ones guilty of large-scale fraudulent financial practices? After the 2008 economic meltdown, not a single Wall Street CEO was called to account by authorities. If Trump had not run for president, none of this SHIT would have been exposed. So, Bill, that was my frustration. My frustration was what she was talking about I'm sure accurate, documented, all the abuse was clearly real. But you and I both know that if he hadn't run for president, all those things would still have been there, but nobody would have accused him of anything. And there wouldn't be the concern about him paying $250 million in some sort of, you know, response to this civil lawsuit. He would not have been turned into the IRS. He would not have been turned in to the Justice Department. But at the same time, he's not the only one. And I am still grieving about what happened in 2008, where we bailed out Wall Street that took us to our knees and no one did a perk walk. So in a large way, what you're seeing now is there are two systems of justice, one for the very rich and one for the rest of us.
I think we can all agree on that. In New York, you know, it is true, the Attorney General's office there has done quite a few things over the years, especially as regards Trump, Trump University, the Trump Foundation, all gone and damages paid. And now this. The good news about this case is that it will send a very large message to everybody else doing business in real estate in New York about what you can and cannot get away with. Just by highlighting this particular corruption, I think we do some good. And I think this case looks very strong. The people on television don't seem to understand. There's been a lot of discussion about the problems in actually bringing the case, and there are some. And who knows how it'll eventually come out. But this is a very strong case. It does not contain the kinds of problems that people talk about in similar cases where you can't prove the guy knew how much the property was worth. You can prove he didn't. He knew there weren't 30,000 square feet in his 10,000 square foot apartment. You can prove he submitted diametrically opposed valuations of the same property on the same day. These are easy. And the second thing I think people haven't quite imagined is Trump on the stand. And you have a right to cite the Fifth Amendment. You can't be compelled to testify against yourself, but you can be compelled to take the stand, and he will. And there he'll be asked a set of questions in which he's going to spend hours taking the Fifth in public in front of a jury. And when that is over, I think even his Teflon reputation will have been pretty well dinged up. And I have little doubt as to the conclusions the jury will reach. And so, one, I think this is very real as it pertains to Trump. But two, to go to your question, it's going to have an impact not just on real estate corruption, but on all prosecutions of corruption. Maybe Trump's final gift to us will be to set off an era in which that begins to happen.
This is exactly what I wanted you to say, Bill, because that's what was going through my head. And Harold, so when I was listening to Bill saying, well, you know, they did like stop him with Trump University and these Trump foundations. Let me just say something. Trump University and Trump foundations, that really didn't have anything to do with the financial market. That didn't have anything to do with real estate. That didn't have to do with anything, which is really the heart of the corruption, both in Trump and frankly, so much that happens in New York City. So why this is so different is, yeah, you can point to things in the past that they slapped him around for and he had to pay something to settle it. But none of those things went to where I think everybody should be nauseous in New York. If you own a building, you better start looking at how you've assessed it. If you're a banker and you've started, you know, giving these loans, I keep complaining about the fact that the founder of we renamed our business school in New Hampshire, the Peter Paul, whatever his name is, Peter T. Paul School of Business and Economics. You know who Peter T. Paul was? He's the creator of liar loans. Now, liar loans were about little people. Well, now what you see with Donald Trump is these are about mega liar loans. And everybody knew and everyone winked and nod. And what Letitia James pointed out about Trump is something that has to chill a lot of other people. They may not have been of extreme, but guess what? They're getting away with it.
And one of the reasons they, you know, that people get away with this, that New York developers and real estate magnates get away with this, is they are comprise a huge percentage of the donors in New York state elections and New York City elections. Eric
Excellent
Adams,
point.
Mr. Cuomo, so on. They are all pillars of the political establishment, no matter how, you know, ridiculous their deeds may be and illegal their deals may be, they are an absolute dominant force, finance and real estate, in New York elections. And if anything cries out
exactly.
for public financing,
yes.
This is this.
Well, and so in a lot of ways, Bill, that's why I want this to be a bigger story than just Donald Trump. I don't want it to begin and end with Donald Trump. I don't want it to begin and end with the referral to the IRS and the referral to the AG. I want someone to say exactly what Harold just said and what you have said, Bill, is that to sort of take this and say, so why has this corruption gone on for so long? Why did it take Donald Trump to run for president for us to acknowledge what was happening in clear sight? Every banker knew it. Come on, everyone in the real estate development business knew it. Everybody knew it, but he got away with it. Well, the most important thing is that now maybe we need to make a connection between the financing of campaigns, because when you buy and sell a DA or when you buy and sell a mayor, you don't get the kind of justice that you deserve. And frankly, if these boys aren't paying, guess who is? We are. The public is making up the difference. And so I do think this is really a wonderful moment to go beyond Trump and to use Trump as really sort of your bloody shirt and say, we need to correct this because it's not just him, Bill.
It is critical that we recognize, first of all, that corruption, along with the persecution of embattled minorities, is one of the two calling cards of fascism. That's how they get into the game, and they all promise to drain the swamp, and then they all make the swamp much swampier than it had ever been. That's their deal. That's what they do. Again, I want to speak to the Democratic Party, that Harold's point is just overwhelmingly important. The campaign finance system is the culprit here, and our lack of interest, whether it's Obama not wanting to pursue miscreants on Wall Street after the meltdown, but why pick him? There's 100 of them. When Hillary and Bill Clinton take $500 million in corporate speaking and consulting fees after leaving their public sector jobs. Right. When Joe Biden gets as much money from the banking industry from the state of Delaware as he did. When Obama outraises McCain on Wall Street, the first Democrat to do that, ending an historic run by the Republicans. We have sold our souls to our donors. And our donors are the devil. And so we have to, if we won't begin, Harold's exactly right. Until that changes, the chance of our getting back what Malcolm Sparrow at Harvard says, 12% of all the entire Medicaid budget is lost to fraud every year. And you can't get people to investigate it because that's not where their bread is buttered. We handed that issue. Trump didn't steal that issue. We gifted it to him. In 2016, because of our own behavior, because of our own policies, we have to ask every progressive constituency, not just Common Cause and Crew and the process people, every progressive constituency, starting with labor, going through environmentalists, every embattled minority, have to put corruption at the top of the list, or we're going to continue to fail the people we love, and they're going to continue to turn away from us.
If we use this opportunity with Trump, we actually then appeal in a bipartisan way. Because what we have said is that this is not about Trump. This is really about, a pattern of and practice of corruption. And if we are going to deal with it, it's not only Trump that should have the book thrown at him. It's not only Trump that should be turned into the IRS. It's not only Trump. He may have done the most abusive that we could possibly imagine. But guess what? It's been a creeping crawl for decades. And the way for us to make sure that, using Letitia James' words, use her very words, that there aren't two systems of justice, that if there's something broken, then both sides need to understand it. This is a wonderful opportunity to appeal to them and say, we need to deal with this because it's not just Trump. And I think if we say that, I'm not sure we get maybe 5 votes from Republicans, but if nothing else, it really does show that we are looking for a true level playing field and we're not putting the finger on the scale of justice.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that all Americans basically still agree on, even in a time like this, is that it is a swamp. Both sides agree with that. Where you go from there in terms of getting Republican support, as you just said, Arnie, isn't entirely clear. But if you go there, there's nothing to lose politically. And I think there's a good deal to gain, because Americans plainly, and there's no dispute about this, think that, to use the language of Elizabeth Warren, that the system is rigged, that it favors money. Yeah. Everyone knows that. Despite the fact that everyone knows that, here we are. Money has not been dislodged from its dominance over our political system. So I think it's a no-brainer. Obviously, we need to make that case. And what Tish James just did in New York is the kind of thing that we need to highlight.
I want to turn to something that I think everyone is feeling, and that is what Fed Chair Powell is doing. And there was an article that I linked to that says there isn't a painless way to do this. And he has been raising interest rates ad nauseum. He is talking about the fact that he wants to see unemployment increase. And what I think is so fascinating about this bill is that if you talk to employers, they're desperate for workers. They're desperate for, they can't even accomplish the task. I mean, we're hiring 14-year-olds at the local market basket. I mean, the kids come up to my navel and they're like behind the counter and I'm like, oh my God. So the idea that we want to increase unemployment is sort of ironic because to a large extent, it almost feels like the whole issue of getting workers is so crucial for even the survival of the economy. And now you want to spike unemployment. And when they say there isn't a painless way to do this, well, that's not true. For the rich, it's always painless. For everybody else, the pain is acute, especially acute now with we don't have the child tax credit. We're looking at the cost of energy, doubling the cost of electricity in my state in the middle of a winter going forward. I mean, you look at this and I'm going, who usually suffers the pain are the same people. And then you want to know why people take it out on politicians. Well, the Fed chair has actually exacerbated the situation.
I want to get to Harold's point a bit that people with passive income actually do better with high interest rates. People with earned income suffer. Okay. End of story. Number two, almost all of these inflationary pressures have real world dynamics that are driving them, institutional failures, policy failures that are driving them. The insistence of our elites in discussing inflation as an abstract, as the abstract result of psychological factors, of pay, of monetary policy, money supply, interest rates, deficits, and debt. No, and this is such a great learning moment for everyone right now. The cost of food is up because of climate change. The cost of food is up because of Ukraine. The cost of food is up because of the system we have, which is so centralized. The cost of food is up because of our immigration policy, because they can't get the workers and fill these jobs. The cost of cars are up because of supply chain problems and because of profit taking. People are price gouging. And you can go through, we talked about housing last week, and why don't we have housing? It's not just about mortgage costs. It's not about expectations of buyers or sellers. It's about the fact that we let millions of units of housing in our cities die because we didn't take care of in unfair property tax rates and insurance premiums, safe streets, schools, brownfields, exclusionary zoning, redlining. We have so many things we could do that are simply about changing the rules under which the system operates in order to expand the supply of housing. I could name 10 of the factors. And the fact that we sit here with this Fed doing a crude medieval surgery, sawing off limbs with no science to support it, it is another example of the degree to which the elites have their own ideology. They're more subtle about it. And if we had a real strong progressive party in this country, it would make that point every day of the week, many times every day, and we'd get it across.
What I'm waiting for is someone to define what is driving this inflation. As you heard just from Bill, what is driving inflation? The climate crisis. What is driving this inflation is Ukraine. What is driving this inflation is supply chain. What's driving this inflation is containers. What's driving this inflation is China. Let me give you another, I'll give you a number. 28% of home sales went to investors last year, up from 16% in 2018 before the pandemic. Most homes sold to investors are bought, they buy lower cost homes and they flip them at a much higher cost. Now you tell me why there's a problem with affordable housing. You better ask an investor, not a homeowner. Why don't I hear this from Democrats? We all sort of just genuflect to whatever Powell is doing when we have to sort of say his blunt instrument doesn't work on home sales.
And
his
blunt
instrument isn't gonna work on any of these things.
What's particularly ridiculous in all of this is that we went through the late 70s and early 80s doing the same mistake and stuff, and we know what the consequences of that are. Paul Volcker, as head of the Fed then, raised interest rates at times close to 20%. What he did was he managed to wipe out the lion's share of Midwest factories and industries, which, you know, since then, everybody now acknowledges was a disaster. We wiped out one part of working class employment that had decent pay and stable benefits and job security and what have you. we can point to Ukraine now, we can point to OPEC then. You know, there are specific causes other than, you know, workers are living too high off the hog.
I know.
Are really, you know, what's behind the kind of price increases.
And that's Powell's theory, that too many Americans have jobs and that too many working Americans are being paid too well.
Yeah.
And that is the fundamental idea that supports this entire enterprise at the Fed and has. And I just don't, you know, I'll never understand why the Democratic Party, well, actually, Harold explained it earlier in the program, but that we can't free ourselves from this, that we don't have enough people standing up and saying, man, take a look at that naked emperor. Boy, there's not a stitch on this guy. We got to do something better here.
Actually, what's interesting is I'm glad you mentioned this, Bill, but I want to talk about what the Fed is doing and how it's going to drive up unemployment and how people are going to be hurting, and you know exactly who's going to be hurting. And I want to connect it to Donald Trump's QAnon cult rally. If you thought the fever was breaking, think again. Yes, it was really as bad as you think, with the Mussolini-style rants, okay? So, and the reason I want to bring this up is that that's exactly what Donald Trump will appeal to. What Powell is doing is laying a welcome mat for people to be angry, because here is government basically blaming workers for their problem, basically suggesting that unemployment is good for the economy, except if you can't, you know, if you can't buy your food, you can't go to a doctor, and you can't pay for the rent. Tell me, whose economy is it good for? And then you see corporations, you know, making money hand over fist. That, you know, Donald Trump QAnon cult rally will become more of a regular event, because he will connect those dots.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he connects them, you know, to fictions, but he connects them.
Yes.
And, you know, if you look at the political changes in working class voting, yes, they do stem in significant part, obviously not entirely, but in significant part from the sense that workers have been discarded and there are elites out to get them. Now, the Republicans and Trump, have other elites in mind. It's not the people who are actually responsible for this. But if you look at, you know, the effect of what Volcker did, again, long term to, let's say, the politics of Ohio, and deunionization is a big part of this, you know, the rightward movement of the white working class. Yeah, that's something that historically fascists and currently the Trumpies can take very, very clear advantage of.
We have not talked about the Trump judge who abused her discretion. And we now know that it has been appealed. Eileen Cannon's abuse of her discretion has been appealed to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta. And the three judges, two of which were appointed by Trump, which is kind of amazing, basically slapped her down. Very politely, Bill, but they slapped her down. So I'm kind of curious here. Because I think a lot of us are making the assumption that, you know, if the Federalist Society suggested this judge and if Trump appointed this judge, then all these judges would genuflect to whatever Donald Trump wanted. But we are beginning to see even a schism within the Trump judges, the Eileen Cannons, who gets, you know, picked at the very last minute in the most perfect location of Florida. You could imagine that would sort of benefit Donald Trump. But these other judges are realizing even the abuse has gone overboard, and they can't accept it. We actually saw this with the shadow docket with Roberts and Kavanaugh. I mean, Roberts and Kavanaugh just said, you're pushing your buttons on the shadow docket with Yeshiva University, and they sided with the three liberals. Why? Because of abuse of the shadow docket. So I think what's really, really interesting is I think even the judges are beginning to question how far can they go in the kind of abuse that Donald Trump expects of them.
What we all know is that Trump and the Federalists have stashed away quite a few Judge Cannons in the system, and there are going to be lots of individual cases in which there will be law that bad decided. And I just hope it brings, again, the Democratic Party. Our job is to figure out what we're doing wrong. Our job is to accept responsibility for the things that we were supposed to do and that we didn't do. We shouldn't give up putting pressure on Biden, even as we support him in his work. And that includes the Supreme Court, because with all those cannons stashed away in federal district courts all over the country, you're either going to get ethics reform and term limits in the Supreme Court. And I would be 100% for increasing its membership by at least a couple. But you have to get a commitment. And the problem, as always, is in the elite of our own party. and their resistance to systemic change of any kind. It's a phrase they love, systemic change. They use it all the time. And they're never for it. I mean, they're just never, ever for it. And this is an example. This system is badly broken. One fascist in 4 years was able to degrade the quality of justice in this country almost beyond recognition. You've got to change the system that we're using to appoint these judges. And you've got to start at the Supreme Court, take control there.
Bill mentioned there are Eileen canons, like basically sort of strategically placed all over the judicial system. Actually, four of them are on the Supreme Court.
Hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, yeah, hiding in plain sight. And we see that. And I do think that it's going to be very, very interesting to sort of see how we can begin to process how to address the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court is going to be there, at least in my perpetuity. And unless we expand the court, unless we demand something in the way of a code of ethics, unless we do something to them, they will basically be the most abusive, you know, aspect of our federal system.
It's not just Trump, though. Remember, I think the two worst justices on the Supreme Court are Thomas and Alito, who were appointed by the successive Bush president. So the degradation of justice predates Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, isn't that interesting? And we're talking about the degradation of justice predates Donald Trump. What we saw with Letitia James, well, you know, what the abuse that we see with Donald Trump predates Donald Trump. So again, in a way, that's the whole story here. And if you don't acknowledge it at the very beginning, then you get the rot like we saw with Donald Trump. Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician, a two-time Democratic nominee for governor, and advisor to Bill Clinton. Harold Meyerson is an editor-at-large at the American Prospect. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the Friday edition. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure, as always.
Always good to be here, Arnie.
All right, everyone. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze on Monday.